start with Senate Bill 392. Marjorie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 392 had its initial public hearing on the 25th of February. It creates the Alternative Medicine Task Force and directs the task force to study and make recommendations on health insurance coverage for alternative health care services. At the time of its first public hearing, we heard some concerns from the committee and drafted the Dash 1 amendment, which is attached to your staff measure summary. You have a hand-engrossed version of the bill and the Dash 1 amendment, but let me describe what that amendment does. Okay. First of all, it removes the emergency clause on the measure. It requires the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House to appoint task force members representing the health insurers and Oregon businesses, and that's rather than the governor making those appointments. It allows designees of the Director of the Department of Human Services and the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to participate in the task force rather than the director specifically participating in that task force. It requires the task force to submit their report and recommendations for legislation to an appropriate interim committee with jurisdiction over human services rather than submitting legislation on their own. It also clarifies that the members who are not legislators are not entitled to compensation for travel and other expenses, nor are they receiving per diem. And it sunsets the task force on December 31st, 2004, rather than December 31st, 2005.
Okay. Thank you. Mark Kyle, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Art Kyle, representing the Association of Naturopathic Physicians. When these, I was going to outline the amendments that were so carefully outlined by Marjorie that we agreed to the last time, and we certainly support those. I agreed to them in the last hearing and still do. I think they're very appropriate.
That's it.
And what else do you need to say?
What do I need to say?
Mr. Chair, let me remind you that this bill does not have a fiscal impact has not been prepared for the Dash 1 amendment. However, I did talk with Legislative Fiscal, and I think that we've decided that the impact on the original bill from Department of Human Services would be reduced or removed entirely. However, we still have the quote-unquote warning about the cost to legislative administration who will have to staff this committee. If every committee in the building approves multiple task forces during session, then it's possible that LAC, if LAC is to staff those, would have to hire an additional person to help staff those task forces. So it's not necessarily an impact, it's just kind of a warning.
Okay.
I just figured that we've made you guys work 48 hours a day.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, we're certainly here to help. Whatever you need.
You ought to be building your muscles up to where you can carry a heavier load.
That's right. That's it. That's it.
I'll do what you ask.
Could you address this?
And that's what I just did.
Well, but you didn't talk amongst. What you're, I want to be clear, I understand what you're saying. If there's $130,000 that would be...
And again, Mr. Chair, that was the quote-unquote warning that if multiple task forces are approved by the legislature and legislative administration doesn't have the staff to provide services for all of those task forces, then it's possible they would have to hire an additional staff person.
To
staff...
How many task forces are multiple, do you think, for that amount? I mean, just to give us a ballpark figure.
During an average interim, I think each staff person works on 3 to 5 to 6 different committees.
Okay. And so...
So, again, it depends on how many task forces are approved by the legislature, which will be staffed by legislative administration, and any other committees that are appointed by... Okay.
Let me ask the question over again. There is a figure here of $134,000, and if we had to hire an extra person, how many would that only staff 3 extra committees in or 3 task force? That amount?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's my guess.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Seeing no other questions. Thank you, Art.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will close the public hearing and open a work session. Discussion. Motions, no discussions, no motions.
Chairman,
yes.
The dash one amendments are the...
I'm sorry, dash one amendments, motion.
Move the adoption of the dash one amendments, Senate Bill 392.
Okay. We have a motion to adopt the dash one amendments for Senate Bill 392. Do I hear any comments, negative comments? Hearing none, we will adopt the dash one amendments to 392.
Well, since nobody else wants to do it, I'll do it. I'd move Senate Bill 392 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved that 392 go to the floor with a due pass, Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, discussion.
I just wanted to say that I don't mind the thrust of the bill at all, but I still have reservations on Saddle and Establishing Task Forces, and I'm going to support this, but a bit reluctantly from that standpoint only.
Is there any way for us to know how many task forces at this point it looks like we're going to have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, we could certainly do a search on how many bills are out there that the legislature would have to staff, but at this point, it's a matter of making it through the process, too.
Senator Menendez.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only thing I will say is that the only way the legislature can gain useful information for future public policy discussions is the use of task forces and bodies like this. So I guess my argument to leadership would be that this is an investment well worth our time. So on one hand, we can argue it's going to cost additional money. On the other hand, we can argue how informed do we want to be when we make broad, large-scale public policy decisions. So I think it is an investment well worth our energy and time and our money, and if that includes hiring an additional interim staff person, I think as an independent third part of the government, we ought to do that. I think we short-sheet ourselves on a regular basis in the Legislative Assembly with hiring the right kind of persons with the right kind of background to help facilitate legislators in the decision-making that we are required to do. So I support it wholeheartedly, and I would support an increase in the Legislative Assembly budget for the purpose of additional staff in permanent residency in the Legislative Assembly and also for these kinds of task forces.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments, and I agree. I think that I've served on a number of task forces four task forces last interim, and learned a lot, some of which I learned convinced me that we should not move forward with the idea. Other discussions convinced me that we should not attempt to legislate until we do some further studies, and I think I agree. I think that's a vital part of the legislative process that I know it's time-consuming and sometimes expensive, but I think it's very well worth the time and the money. So thank you for articulating that. Would the clerk... other comments? Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Menendez?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye. Senator Shields will carry the bill. What would you carry the bill? Thank you. Okay, the next bill we will hear is House Bill 2487. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. 2487. Okay, we'll open the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2487 exempts home health agencies but also provide personal care services from the requirement to obtain an in-home care agency license and clarifies that home health agencies may provide personal care services.
Okay, we do have Sarah Reeder.
Would you?
Well, please.
Do we have a house?
Hi.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for bringing this bill so quickly before this Senate Health Policy Committee. We will note that the reason why we needed to bring this so quickly through the process is that there is current requirement now that this bill fixes that will alleviate the problem for home health agencies having to apply for two licenses, one under the home health statute and one under the new in-home care statute. We have support from all stakeholders in this, and I believe the Oregon Health Division will also testify in support. This bill did pass out of the House Health and Human Services Committee and the floor unanimously, and we'd appreciate your support on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator, you're losing your opportunity to have a very impressive looking wall with all these licenses up on it.
Well, we'll pass on that, and we appreciate having just the one to provide the similar types of care.
Okay.
Aye.
Seeing no further questions, do we have... Thank you. Anyone else interested in testifying? Oh, would you come up, please, and introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to do so.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I am the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems for the Department of Human Services. And as we did on the House side, I wanted to be available on as this bill reached the Senate side to testify in support of it. I don't want to take up the committee's time any more than may be necessary. At the risk of being glib, I could say good bill should pass. It removes a conflict. Fiscal impact is extremely negligible. Streamlines the system for folks who want to provide rehabilitative, who are already licensed to provide rehabilitative care, to allow them to also provide maintenance care like grooming, bathing, and so on. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay.
Karen.
Yes.
I've been wondering where Ms. Shibley has gone since she was a member of the House of Representatives. Now I know.
recently back.
I see. Well, yes. Congratulations and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the Honorable Senator. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Okay. Any other individuals wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I would move that we send House Bill 2487 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Fisher moves House Bill 2487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker? Senator
Fisher?
Aye.
And Senator
Morissette? Aye.
And your carrier?
Senator Fisher has consented to carry the bill. Thank you very much. So at this time we will, while we have finished that bill and we're waiting for Barney Spate to be here to give us...
Where's
Barney? Ah, Barney is sitting by the window behind the drapes. Come on.
Behind the drapes.
He's always been a shady character.
Trying to keep the glare down from my bald head.
We were thinking it was curtains for you.
Now, Barney, I must caution you. I've sat through some of the meetings that you facilitated, and I hope that you have... I hope you bring us better news than we had the last time I attended a meeting. I missed the very last meeting, but it was pretty grim, and I hope you've had a chance to cook the numbers and make it at least sound better.
You cook the numbers, make it sound better.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I'm appearing today, however, as the facilitator, and I would emphasize the word facilitator, of a stakeholder group that was put together at the request of Chair Westland, that included Representatives Westland, Cruz, and Bates, and Senators Morissette, Winters, and Carter, and representatives of the medical community, the hospital community, the pharmacy community, consumers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and others, along with House and Senate staff, representatives from the governor's office and DHS and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. The purpose of the stakeholder group was to look at the governor's proposed budget and some assumptions that I'll get into in a minute about how much funds were potentially available for the Oregon Health Plan, and to begin crafting recommendations that could be used in helping frame the budget discussions for the OHP and the 03-05 biennium. I think before you, Ms. Taylor's made available some draft materials that I'll reference as I go through this. I would again like to characterize that my role was to try to facilitate the group working with staff as far as planning the agenda. And as I walk through this, I'll try to give you a flavor of where the consensus of the group was or is, and where there may be kind of policy debates at hand. But unfortunately, what I have to deliver today is probably grim would be an optimistic characterization, because I think we all confront some really big questions in the future of the Oregon Health Plan in the context of today's revenue forecasts. Let me start with the handout that's labeled Stakeholder Group Initial Recommendations Summary, and it's Revision 6. What this does is mainly overlay or give an overview of the broad budgetary assumptions that this work group used. We started with the governor's balanced budget, which in state funds, which would include both general fund and tobacco tax funds, the governor's balanced budget proposes allocating approximately $992 million to the Oregon Health Plan. The committee, the stakeholder work group, at the direction of legislative leaders, thought it would be best to actually back down from reduce that amount to a level of about $933 million. That's a 10% reduction in general fund, mainly to acknowledge the fact that when the governor's balanced budget was put together, the complete a less than complete picture of 03-05 revenue projections was available, and of course they're less positive now than they were then. So the budgetary target we started with was, what kind of program can the state put together, beginning thinking of this as a series of building blocks, with $933 million of state resources, again, general fund and tobacco tax. The numbers that I give you throughout my presentation today will be state funds only, because that's the basis of how we work. There are lots of other fundings, other fund and federal funds at play in this. The first question that one has to ask in this endeavor is, does the state want to have a Medicaid program? And there was broad affirmation to the answer to that is yes. Because in answering the question yes, we started with what's the minimum requirements that the federal government requires of a state to have a Medicaid program, to be in the federal-state partnership known as Medicaid. And laid out on page 2 of this first handout are federal minimums, and there are really two sets of minimums. One would be the minimum populations that states must cover, for example, adults and children in TANF households, temporary assistance to needy families, poverty level children, poverty level pregnant women, blind, disabled, the aged, and children in state custody. So there's a known requirement of categories of people who must be covered under a state Medicaid program. Then we ask the question, what are the minimum services that the federal government requires for those minimum populations? And those are generally summarized in the same document, about the middle of page 2, where it talks about physician services, lab and x-ray, inpatient, outpatient, hospital, early periodic screening, diagnostic treatment for children, which gives children up to the age of 19 a more comprehensive benefit package, some medical transportation, home health, and some other health care services. Not included in the federal minimum benefit package for a Medicaid program are services such as prescription drug. However, there is no state in the union that has a Medicaid program without a prescription drug program, durable medical equipment, mental health services, and addiction or chemical dependency services. The agency, the Office of Medical Assistance Program, fondly known as OMAP, and DHS gave the work group an estimate that to purchase for 0305 those mandatory minimum services for the estimated 348,000 mandatory minimum mandatory populations that are estimated in the 0305 biennium, that the cost of that coverage would be about $837 million in state funds, which leaves, using the adjusted governor's balance, about $96 million left to deploy either in additional benefits or additional coverage of people. Moving on to page 3, we then looked at and asked...
Chairman. Yes, Senator Mass.
Barney, I want to make sure I'm following you here. This $837 million... It does not include pharmaceutical.
It does not, Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace. It does not. It would include basically hospital doc services, and for children under 18, it would have drugs for children because of the early what's known as EPSDT.
Right.
But for the adults in the population, there would be no pharmaceutical benefit or the other three benefits that we talked about. And so our next step was looking at what the consensus of the group was, and this is across the medical provider community and the agency and the consumer, is that we clearly want to have a prescription drug benefit. We want to have some DME, if not a complete DME package, and then the necessity for mental health and addiction services was also agreed to. So we asked the agency to price the buyback, if you will, of putting those four services onto the federal minimum services, and what would that cost. And as you can see on page 3 at the box, about two-thirds of the way down, that the cost to add prescription drugs and the other health benefits was costed out at $259.4 million.
Mr. Chairman. Question, Barney. This $837 million, is that assuming a Medicaid program mandatory population at what level of federal poverty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I believe it. Each of the categories have a different federal poverty level. It's not uniform in the sense, like the current Oregon health plan, is that if you are categorically eligible and above the federal poverty level for that category, but nonetheless under 100% of the poverty level, you get an Oregon health plan benefit. I can get you the exact numbers, but it ranges something like for TANF it may be 50-some percent of the poverty level. For the aged, blind, and disabled, it's up in the 70s or high 70s. So it does vary by category. For children, it goes up to 133 poverty level children, and for pregnant women, it goes up to 133%. So as opposed to being what you could kind of think of now, that we have a kind of a uniform eligibility at 100%, regardless of categories, it will become more varied based upon category.
And, Mr. Chairman, that, I guess that was the point I was trying to get to, is that we were going to make assumptions predicated upon the work of the current waiver that we accepted, that assumed that we would go below the 100% of the federal poverty level.
The work that we've done kind of looked at in building this budget on a kind of block-by-block basis. It did not start from any assumptions about the current waiver, but more building from the federal minimum up to that, to understand getting back to that, and we'll get into that a little bit.
Okay.
So that left a projected shortfall of about $163.4 million, and at that point, the stakeholder group was asked to spend one additional week, and that was last week, to spend 3 hours Monday night and 3 hours Wednesday night looking at and discussing potential strategies that could be used to close that $163.4 million gap and to then deploy those savings, if you will, to buy back as much of those four benefit packages as possible. Now I will turn to the second handout that you've been given, where it talks about Oregon Health Plan cost containment actions, and try to summarize some of the discussions and findings and concepts that were discussed during those two meetings last week, which were about 6 hours in their entirety. We looked first at the prescription drug benefit to understand where potential savings could be had in a state prescription drug program, and we looked at it from a very kind of broad strategic point of view. There are six questions on each of the bullets there on page one that really goes to some fundamental policy and management issues about how the state should manage or could manage a prescription drug program. And then we looked at there's about six general options that I'll discuss in some detail. The first question and the large fundamental question about how the state can save additional money in a prescription drug program is under point one on page one, and that would be to change current policy and to carve out all of the prescription drugs which are currently paid on a capitation basis to the fully capitated health plans, the FCHP. That acronym means fully capitated health plan. They currently receive a fixed per member per month amount every month for prescription drugs. They work with pharmacy benefit managers and the prescription drug industry and their provider networks to put together formularies and other management techniques to use that capitation to buy prescription drugs, pay for prescription drugs for their enrolled population. Under the carve-out, the state would, in fact, then buy all of the prescription drugs. The fully capitated health plans, under this concept that's articulated in point one, would be paid an administrative fee for continuing to manage those drugs as they are now, but they would not receive the capitation payment. And what happens in this model is that the state then, under the federal-state partnership, would be able to increase the rebates it receives via federal law, and most of the savings, that $19.4 million in savings, is because of enhanced rebates. Now the issue that was talked about in increasing the rebates is kind of a straightforward way for the state to lower its expenditures in prescription drug, but it needs to be done with some care, because if you have a prescription drug program with little or no management, then the utilization of drugs and the mix of drugs, brand versus generic, et cetera, can change quite rapidly, and whatever you gain in savings for rebates could be lost through substantially modified utilization where the costs would be higher. And so there's a great deal of talk, and I think will be more work, there's more conceptual work and more program planning work about how could this be done, but there's great interest that the FCHPs would play a major management role, but the drugs would be the purchaser for both the fee-for-service and the fully capitated health plans. This assumes, point one, and also assumes that the fee-for-service program drug program would continue to be managed as it is now by the state agency. And I'll get into another initiative that changes that when we get to number four on page two.
So, Mr. Chairman.
30 minutes.
These are hypothetical situations, right?
This is a model, a concept that is hypothetical in the sense that it's not being done now, but it can be done under federal state law.
Well, tell me about that then. Under Senate Bill 819 from last session, how does number one fit into the mandates of 819?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, as I understand it, Senate Bill 819 would continue to apply to the fee-for-service drug program that would be managed by the state agency, but each of the FCHPs would be able to use its own management construct, which includes their own formularies.
Would they not have to follow the state law with respect to that concept and that construct?
I believe the concept that's part of the aspect of your question relative to point one is that they would not be subject to Senate Bill 819. They would be subject to, they would have, if you will, the flexibility to design their own drug management approach or to use existing drug management approaches.
So, Mr. Chairman, you'd have to pass new law, circling on 819.
I'm not, Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I'm not certain about that because, as I understand it, I thought Senate Bill 819 applied primarily, if not exclusively, to the management of the fee-for-service drug programs outside the FCHP.
Well, the issue, Mr. Chairman, that I want to get to is that the prescription practitioner-managed prescription drug program was, in fact, a program to be managed by practitioners. To the extent that you get involved in formularies or FCHPs and you take that authority out and you create a whole new gatekeeping process or prior authorization methodologies, you circumvent the intent of that law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I think your point is well taken. When I get down to number four on page two, I can't respond other than I don't think 819 is an impediment to the concept in one. It would certainly be, and maybe this is the best time to jump, I'll just jump to concept four on page two, and that would be there was lots of discussion about how do we strengthen the management of the fee-for-service drug program, and point four articulates a concept that to actually have the fully capitated health plans, most of whom are local provider organizations, to actually manage the fee-for-service drug program and the drug program for the enrollees in their health plan. And in this context, since the FCHPs would be acting as an agent of the state in their management, I think Senator Minnis's earlier comment would in fact be true, and that is there may be the need for clarifying legislation to permit this to happen, if that makes sense. Is that responsive, Mr. Senator Minnis?
I think we're hitting around the same point.
Same, okay.
Here, I mean, I'm going back to my speech on the Senate floor in 2001 and the corresponding floor speech by Representative Cruz, who carried the bill in the Senate. I know we're dealing with issues of prior authorization, although 819 is not specific to the issue of prior authorization. There were comments made in the carrying of those bills on the floor, which established legislative intent and were consistent with my negotiations with Governor Kitzhaber at the time. So it is an issue that I think this legislature will have to deal with because it has a lot to do with whether or not you build walls between the practitioners and their care of their patients that are arbitrary and capricious.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I would concur with what you just said, and I think that if there's a bias may be the wrong term, but if there is a there's a perspective out of the discussions about how to use the fully capitated health plans more broadly in managing benefits like prescription drugs and perhaps even benefits like durable medical equipment, it is the fact that that most, if not all, of the fully capitated health plans have very strong management governance links into their communities, and so that they're actually closer to the practitioners and providers and can be more responsive. But I clearly understand your comment about the intent of what 819 was.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to be argumentative or maybe too far off point, but I did receive a letter from the current governor with respect to what he's intending, and it looks a lot like some of the stuff that appears on this memorandum. And I'm saying that because I can't remember why I said that. Well, yeah, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought on this whole. the company, this is the point, the company that I understand is going to be managing that under the governor's proposal is actually based in Virginia. So when we talk about local control and local benefit management companies or whatever they are, I guess I would take issue with the company in Virginia being close to the constituent groups, constituent populations in Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, the concepts I'm attempting to describe this afternoon really both points 1 and 4 are to use the existing fully capitated health plans in lieu of an organization, I think it's called First Health, which the state contracts with for its fee-for-service.
That is the Virginia company, correct?
That is the Virginia company. And there are, and you'll see, I think, in some other places in these list of actions and issues, some reference to First Health and some other concepts that the state agency has developed that we can get into and discuss further. Let me now move back to item two, which is an enhanced prior authorization for prescription drugs, estimated savings about $2.7 million. And this, in fact, would be presumed to apply to the Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service clients, in which you'll notice the acronym PDL, the preferred drug list, which is the list that was developed via the authorizing legislation of 01, Senate Bill 819, would use the PDL and actually strengthen or place new administrative requirements around it, which is known as enhanced prior authorization, that would require physician approval prior to having a non-PDL drug prescribed. And I believe this concept number two, Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, would be carried forth by First Health under a contract with the state. And again, we were looking at each of these are to some degree can be linked or can be viewed independently. We were merely trying to get as many of the concepts that were either in the minds of the administration or in the minds of stakeholders on the board to understand kind of what's the magnitude of the savings and what are the policy and principles of management behind each of them. I'll stop there. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Actually, Brian, that's fine. I guess I probably should just be quiet and let you do your presentation so I can just understand what foundation you're building on here. I was going to ask you how this physician permission or grant to write a prescription under this proposal would be accomplished, and I read one portion that says if a physician wants to prescribe a drug not on the PDL to an OHP client, the physician has to note on the prescription, I assume that's the script that they write to send to the pharmacy, that a non-PDL drug is medically necessary, and then it goes on to say that they would have to get prior approval from the state before they could actually prescribe the drug. So I'm a little confused how that might.
I believe that that paragraph and those two sentences that you reference, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, refer to the current process under Senate Bill 819 is in fact, and I think you recall that one of the major provisions of 819 was that a physician could prescribe off the prescribed drug list by merely indicating on the prescription that another drug was necessary for medical reasons.
Right.
I think the core concept behind an enhanced prior authorization would, in fact, be a change in that policy and, again, perhaps require statutory change so that the agency could, in that fact, then require a telephonic discussion with the prescriber before the non-PDL drug could be filled.
Yeah, it would be interesting, Mr. Chairman, at some point to listen to or hear from some specialists like rheumatologists and others when they're trying to find the right anti-inflammatory and NSAID drug to apply to their patient. If one particular drug doesn't appear on the list, then are they going to get on the phone and contact an organization like this and wait to get that approval, and how frequently would the approval be granted, et cetera. So, I'll just lay those on the table and let Marty finish.
Okay. What I'd like you to reiterate, perhaps, is Tell us, Senator Minnis wasn't here when we started this conversation, so I want you to do an overview of what you have arrived at, which is not, these are not recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, they are not. They are, I would consider them to be a long list of potential actions or concepts that were put together through both, I would call, brainstorming by the stakeholder group. Some of the concepts came from the agency and have some degree of development within the agency. And our purpose was to try to have a discussion among the various perspectives of the stakeholder group about the size of the savings some of these concepts or actions could generate, and also what some of the policy or delivery implications, as Senator Minnis has touched upon. This list doesn't really come, and I want to make it sure, and I'm sorry that I didn't say it, doesn't come as necessarily that the stakeholders agree or disagree with any or all of these. There are some that I would say that there's probably more positive interest of exploring further. For example, the carve-out one and number one, but I think Senator Minnis characterized correctly that additional enhanced prior authorization is viewed by some with some trepidation as far as will it work and will it be one more problem for physicians to confront.
Okay. Now, I appreciate the clarification, and I think we need further clarification. My having sat in on some of the meetings, not all of them, was that there was disagreement among the group, among the various stakeholders, about possible savings and how they would have achieved and at whose expense and so on and so forth. And I understand there was a great deal of frustration in that there were not adequate savings to do the kind of things that needed to be done. And I understand that the purpose of this whole exercise is to prepare some recommendation to Ways and Means, and maybe you could enlighten me on what action, if any, the House Audit Committee is planning to take. Are they going to simply bless what's been done here and send it to Ways and Means and say, you figure it out, or are they going to try to narrow it down and come up with some sort of a bill or a recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, it would be somewhat presumptuous of me to respond to that, but let me nonetheless.
Well,
let me tell you what I think.
What the rumors are.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I gave a presentation yesterday to the House Audit Committee at the request of Chair Westland to give an overview again as a facilitator of what came out of the group process generally, and I believe that there will be hearings held this week, and that there's some expectation that, if not all of these recommendations, some of these recommendations may be passed forward to Ways and Means with an urging to look seriously at them, given the amount of work that's gone in through the stakeholder group. Other than that, I don't know whether there's any plans for initiating legislation or things like that.
Okay, thank you. I didn't think that was the case, but I just wanted to know because, as I said, I didn't attend all those meetings. Senator Minnis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple of clarifications here, and I'm not attacking Barney because Barney's the messenger here and facilitating, but a couple of things. The issues you're dealing with here are issues that are substantive issues that belong in substantive policy committees, either the Human Resource Committee of the Senate or the Health Policy Committee here, not in Ways and Means. The questions that you raise about what the House Audit Committee would send to the Ways and Means Committee and what they might do are substantive policy questions which are contrary to the rules and or the history of the work of the Ways and Means Committee. So the Ways and Means should not be making these kind of decisions in their committee based solely on money and or dollar figures. That's why we have policy committees. That's just my little admonition with respect to where the thing should track within the system. Second, based on the governor's letter that I received yesterday, it is clear to me that the governor is already implementing many of these programs contrary to Senate Bill 819, because for whatever reason the governor seems to think he has that authority to do so. I would submit he does not. So while we're talking about these decisions as if they were future decisions, the administration has already implemented them. And I think that that is an issue that needs to be brought before this committee or the Health Services or Health and Human Services Committee, because we have a dichotomy of opinion and a dichotomy of action going on between what the legislature is reviewing and what the executive branch of the government is doing.
Thank you, and I agree. I do agree. I thought that the Substantives Committee would basically be doing this work, and the recommendations would come to the committee, and they would then put something together and send it to Ways and Means for the fiscal. And you're right, Ways and Means deals with money aspects of it, not the value aspect of it. And I think that's a good observation. So,
well, it'd be like changing Measure 11 sentences in Ways and Means because they could save money by not incarcerating people.
Good idea.
The Judiciary Committee would object to that.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And perhaps we should draft a letter and send it to the House Committee. Are you ready?
I'll continue with point three. Another concept or potential action item was looking at how could the state increase what is known as supplemental drug rebates. There are different approaches that the state, either acting by itself, but also particularly acting in a multi-state purchasing arrangement, through an organization such as First Health, again, the current state contractor, could work out arrangements with pharmaceutical manufacturers and their using their preferred drug list to actually increase the amount of rebates above those that are authorized under the federal law. And these would come about because certain brand drugs would be preferred and others would not. This is item three is again more looked at more in the context of the current state fee for service drug program and how to maximize savings out of that. And there was some discussion about the various pooling approaches or bulk purchasing, whichever phrase you want, where states are joining together to do these kinds of activities. And you can see the estimated savings about 1.7 to 2.5 million. I would then turn you to attention to point five on page three. The third basic aspect of the state's prescription drug program, there are three. One is the drug program currently through the fully capitated health plans, which I described as a defined benefit for a defined population and a capitation rate applied to it. The other is, as we've already discussed, is the state's fee-for-service drug program for those clients that are not enrolled in fully capitated health plan. And third part, in which number five addresses, is the mental health drugs. These are antidepressant, antipsychotic drugs, which are managed exclusively on a fee-for-service basis by OMAP and its contracting PBM. And there was discussions about, are there different ways or alternative ways to manage, if not all of the prescription mental health drugs, some of them. And you see there's no savings estimated here. There really was general discussion about models of having the fully capitated health plans and the mental health organizations somehow co-manage or have demonstration projects to more effectively manage the utilization of these drugs. Not much there as far as being definitive. And then I would,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Barney, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm reading into what you're saying more than is there. As I, in my other career, talk with people with mental illness, I also did some interning in a state hospital, mental hospital, years ago. I see a radical difference between the latest state-of-the-art mental health drug and maybe a more generic earlier version of same. Are you talking about any of that kind of management when you're talking about this here, or are you?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields I think probably, yes, I am talking about it, at least in a portion. There are really two large classes of the mental health drugs. The antidepressants, some of the brand names are now available on a generic basis. Much of that describing, clearly I think over half of the prescribing for antidepressants occurs in physicians' offices in the fully capitated health plans as opposed to through mental health clinicians. The antipsychotics that are used for much more intensive therapies in more persistent and critically mentally ill folks are probably not the arena that most of this is being talked about. But I think there is a concern that the fee-for-service mental health drugs don't have a construct of utilization management and review to make sure that the state is getting its value and the patient is getting what the patient needs for mental health treatment. And beyond that statement, there's not a lot of definition about how would we do it better or differently. But I think what you said is...
Barney, if you can follow a conversation between the two of us right now during this musical chairs, you're doing very well. I'm totally lost. The point I want to make, and I really want to make it with the chair as well, is that out on the street, the difference between something that could end up coming to a patient because of a formulary and what they could get because they've got a state-of-the-art antipsychotic drug could mean the difference between that person functioning on the street and that person ending up in the hospital, which will cost a heck of a lot more money than simply giving the person drug in the first place. And I'm kind of asking here, is that seriously being discussed? I wasn't a part of this committee. Senator Morissette, I guess you were part-time. Senator Winters, I guess you've been a part of it. Has that been seriously discussed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I think the operative word you use is seriously. I think the concern has been that the fee-for-service mental health drugs, there's a concern in some quarters that they're not appropriately managed, particularly the antidepressant drugs, not the antipsychotics. So to the extent that there was a general conversation about are there ways that we could do it better, and hence it got on this, it was more, in my view as kind of the generalist keeping the meeting going, it was more looking at the antidepressants and also a public acknowledgement in the meeting that this whole arena of mental health drugs and their management is a very sensitive and critical political social issue because availability it was acknowledged exactly what you said that these drugs save lives and keep people out of institutions.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to apologize to everybody in the committee because I got a little bit animated. Because I'm very passionate about this particular issue from what I have seen, both with people that I go to visit in the hospital in my previous profession and the work that I do among homeless and poor people when they can't get access to those kinds of prescriptions. So my apologies if I get a little bit animated there.
Don't apologize. I also want to set the record straight. I was never invited to be part of that work group as the chair of the Senate Health Policy Committee. And so I had a very animated conversation with Chairman Westland twice, and I finally said, I am going to show up, even if I was not invited. So I did show up a couple of times. But that kind of boggled my mind. So I don't know where all of that came from, where it's going, but I thought this committee was supposed to be dealing with policy, health policy. And apparently it's going to Ways and Means, and would you like to raise your Ways and Means question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll restate it. The subcommittee chair from the Human Resources and Ways and Means here present, she probably won't be surprised by my opinion, but I think that Senator Shields raises some interesting points, and that is that my observation, there's a huge disconnect in this building with respect to public policy and where we go with issues relevant to antidepressants, like, you know, antipsychotic drugs, and what we buy, what the value might be present there. I know that the Judiciary Committee in the interim, myself and Representative Max Williams, attended a conference with representatives of the governor's office back in Boston, looking at issues of incarcerated youth and the issues of mental health and as it applies to youth. It was very clear from all the research that to the extent that you can get mental health services to youth earlier in their lives, get an appropriate diagnosis and get them on the right kind of medication early, there's a huge opportunity to alleviate the number of people who are going into prisons and jails, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the decision making we do in this body that is for the immediate and for the present, to say how can we fit what we're doing within the context of our budget constraints versus what's the right decision. And that's why I think this committee was created. That is part of what my argument was to the leadership when we did create this committee, is that we need to make these decisions with our eyes wide open and understand what the consequences are. So I would submit that regardless, I know that the Ways and Means Committee has a very, very hard job down there to try to fit the targets granted them by the co-chairs. But on the other hand, the argument that we have to have as senators is are we going to change the policy to meet the need and then manage the budget accordingly? That requires us to make some other decisions about where money flows. But, for instance, this is a political question. I would submit that if we did put more money into antipsychotic, antidepressant medications for youth, where appropriately diagnosed, you might alleviate some of the longer-term vicarious costs associated with the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
But we never really get to that point, and that's why I think we have to have these animated discussions. I think it's okay to be animated, and I think we need to be respectful. I mean, Barney, he's a good team player here and comes before us and gives us a lot of good information, and he has to listen to us, and he does a good job of listening to us, and many of us would probably not tolerate it so much. But I guess I'm saying all of this to say that the purpose of this committee and others is to help make those policy decisions and do so with our eyes wide open, do so consciously, and then work very cooperatively with the Ways and Means Committee to say, look, this is an absolute priority, and let's see if we can do what we can.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I may, the discussion, and I wasn't there, if they discussed the issue that you raised, because I do agree with you, as you know, we go back to Senate Bill 819, and it was we deliberately in 819 made certain that we weren't going to, if you will, cut and have those drugs that go to mental health, because I think we were all very concerned to make sure that the individual received what they needed so that they didn't end up in hospitals and what have you. So if that discussion was held, I was not there, and certainly this I still support Senate Bill 819 and what was crafted last session, which we passed. I think that there was some thoughtful discussions around 819 and why we came to that conclusion that there were certain drugs that we believed that we did not want to put people's lives at risk. And I think that still, for me personally, that still holds.
Okay, the larger issue that we discussed, which I think is good to talk about in public instead of meeting behind closed doors somewhere, what is the appropriate venue forum for these, whatever it is we're going to do? I assumed that the House Audit Committee would put together a program of some kind, give it their best shot, and say this is what we want to do, then send it to Ways and Means for an analysis of the request and where the money, you know, how much money is there, and deal with it that way. I was under the impression, in listening to some of the comments, even in the committee, of let's just send it to Ways and Means and let them figure it out. And that, to me, doesn't seem like the right way to do it. So I don't know where we're going.
I believe that originally when the audit committee was put together, it was with that they would work through some of the issues, which, by the way, was to include the input from your committee as well as Senator Fisher's committee and others, so that we are making sure that there is the communication flow in the package before it came down to me in Ways and Means. You know, I was I'm the last piece after all of the policy discussion has taken place. So I'm just waiting for everyone to dot their I's and cross
their T's. Maybe we as a committee need to ask some questions of our counterparts on the House side and get some clarification about the process.
And Mr. Chairman, I think, interestingly, I think Representative Westland originally wanted to have a joint committee. So there may be a little bit of a disconnect in that respect.
But his idea of a joint committee was that this committee be part of his committee and that we spend all of our time dealing with the issue rather than dealing with the other policy issues, because this is not the only policy issue.
I understand that. I'm just saying that I think there was at least an original intent to try to coordinate some of this.
Okay.
Some of the discussion.
Barney, thank you for being here. You're helping us resolve some issues.
Is he done?
No, he's not done.
I didn't know whether I was being excused.
No, you were not being excused. I just appreciate your patience, and I appreciate your...
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to serve, and I'm here for the fellowship.
You kind of got things moving, Barney.
Wonderful.
You have to close us with kumbaya.
I would thank you. Continue, please.
I would summarize the points on page 3 under 6. There are different discussions around a similar point, and that is, are there appropriate ways to increase the use of generic drugs where they're medically appropriate? The fiscal note that sticks in my mind is that for every 1% of increase in the use of generics, there's about a $3 million biennial savings in state funds. And you'll notice that several of these bullets speak to generic drugs, different ways to encourage their use, to promote their use, again, where medically appropriate. And I would remember distinctly writing this on a chart note, is that there was lots of discussion about when generic drugs were appropriate and in situations medically where they may not be appropriate, and the various processes to perhaps put providers through hoops. And the statement I wrote on the chart note was, there's general agreement that increasing the medically appropriate use of generic drugs is agreed to. The issues are really how and by whom that would happen. And so these are just illustrations, if you will, of the various perspectives on that issue. And I would conclude that if the buyback for prescription drugs is clearly over $200 million, there is a belief. I think we came out of in a general belief, while people can disagree both at the policy level and perhaps even at the tactical level, that there probably is some savings in the prescription drug program to be had. The issues are, and I think it's fair that the stakeholder group reckoned with it about the way I heard the colloquies today, and that is there are large policy issues behind each of these strategies, and they need to be thoughtfully evaluated, and the implications from other stakeholders need to be taken into account. With that, I'll stop on the prescription drug and questions.
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge the fact that we do have an additional public hearing. I'm sorry, information hearing at 2:30, so we have about 17 minutes.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Well, Barnett, you being from Kaiser, help me understand how your organization deals with the generic drug issue or a physician's ability to go outside of the formulary if they felt it medically necessary. How do you guys deal with it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, we do have a formulary. The formulary is developed by Permanente physicians in consultation with, since we have our own pharmacy and pharmacists, looking at both issues of medical efficacy and cost. Any Permanente physician can write off the formulary at any time with no adverse professional impact. We do have lots of training and information available to physicians, actually built into our electronic medical record, to encourage the use of generic drugs where they're possible, where they're appropriate. We have, I think, about a 70 to 75% use of generics and about a 95% compliance with the formulary. The power of the rational approach that we use in managing pharmacy benefits is in fact a function of how we are organized, in that the physicians are clearly at the center of a lot of the policy decisions about which drugs are on the list or not, and also a recognition that each physician in confronting a patient situation needs to have the freedom that that formulary drug may in fact not be appropriate for medical reasons. I would say that there are a lot of organizations in the state, independent practice associations and other models, that are developing similar approaches where physicians are at the center of the formulary game, if you will, and don't feel that it's an administrative incursion placed on them from afar, but is in fact close to their medical management, and I think that's a good thing. I think formularies work where physicians believe that they're managed in the best balanced interest of patients and the physician, and they don't work when they're viewed by the medical community as just being forced upon them from outside. I hope that's responsive.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I think it's both responsive and instructive. I think the issue when I participated in negotiations with Governor Kitzhaber over 819 was the central issue over whether or not there was compliance with the formulary or the use of generic drugs had to do with the education or training of physicians and their familiarization with, you know, the utility of those drugs as opposed to ones that they might otherwise be knowledgeable. That's one of the reasons why in this committee I've advocated continuing medical education training programs, even though the medical association is not currently required. I think that we ought to engage in more of those kind of discussions about to what extent are physicians familiar with the use of generic drugs and their efficacies related to other name brands. I think it is an education issue, and it's, as you say, a function of how you are organized, and we tend not to be very well organized in that respect, too. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the last part of my overview of the work of the stakeholder work group starts on page 4 and relates to the Oregon Health Plan delivery system. And there are really two fundamental parts here, and I know that time is short. I just want to touch on both aspects of them. Point 7 on page 4 really looks at a concept that when OMAP put the budget estimates together for Chair Westland's committee and the stakeholder work group, it assumed that the mandatory minimum benefit package would be totally free of and not in any way connected to the prioritized list. And in fact, the question was asked, well, if we use the mandatory minimum benefit package and the prioritized list, that is where we draw a line and below that line certain condition treatment pairs would not be covered, is there savings to be had there? And the response was yes, about 6.5%. Then a further question was asked, if that line was moved somewhat, and the Health Services Commission has worked on the lower quartile of the list, if that line was moved, for example, up about 30 to about, in this example, 519, is there additional savings to be had? And the answer was yes, of something less than 2%. Number 7 really characterizes both of those actions together. These actions would require CMS approval. There's more work going on at looking at what the implications are. But what the concept behind point 7 goes something like this. If we could convince the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that what we want to do is use a prioritized list that we have experience with, as far as knowing that the lower ends of that list are physical medicine interventions that have marginal or questionable value, and if we were to take that savings and then use it to buy additional benefits above the minimum benefits, wouldn't that be a good thing, ask rhetorically of our federal partner? The initial signs, I think there's been one general conversation about this, is that the feds have not closed the door to this concept. But you can see the amount of savings there, $57.8 million, of if you will, combining the prioritized list with the mandatory minimum benefit package. That was, and that's clearly the most sizable savings in magnitude of all of those that we discussed. The last general set of area of interventions or concepts was really looking at, and we had a fairly detailed presentation by the actuary or consulting the consultant that the state uses to help develop rates about kind of the payment rates and the utilization trends that are built into all of these pricing assumptions, and what are the implications of actually lowering the trend, paying providers less than what may be recommended by the actuary as recognizing reasonable cost, etc. And you can see several of these. Number 10 means reducing the capitation rate to assume a different base for hospital reimbursement, lowering provider reimbursements for physicians. And I would want to characterize this, as you probably well know, provider reimbursements and or the level of the growth of provider reimbursements are an incredibly sensitive and big part, if you will, of the politics of Medicaid appropriation. I think every provider group at the table recognizes and appreciates the current situation of the state that it is in relative to available revenues. And each of the provider groups, I think, you know, to one degree or another, probably understand the reality of where we are, but they also point out that the countervailing reality is that payment rates are, in fact, lead directly to participation rates, and that if physicians are to participate either through a fully capitated health plan or in a fee-for-service program, the legislature and the governor's office needs to be aware of how those rates are relative to, for example, Medicare or other state Medicaid programs. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and try to answer any questions for this last piece. There were some issues on management actions by DHS. The committee went through those very quickly. I won't spend any time, but there are some potential savings. I think they're in a second echelon of savings. For example, increased third-party reimbursement, recoveries from third-party reimbursement and things like that, tightening eligibility screening, all of which can be done. We can do better at it to save money. The magnitude is probably not what Senator Winters is looking for to balance the budget.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Mills.
Barney, again, a clarification. The numbers we're looking at are for the mandated populations of the Oregon Health Plan, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, that is correct. And we as a stakeholder group did recognize, and I reiterated to the House committee that what has not been discussed in this framework are the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, the Family Health Insurance Program, FEOP, there would be some reduction in coverage for both, well, particularly for the CHIP children. The CHIP program would take the kids from the mandatory program back to where we are currently today at 185, but without an appropriation for the poverty level pregnant women, they would be at 133, and they're currently at 185. So you're correct. All of this work and these pricings are for the mandatory populations only, and we all acknowledge the sensitivity and desire to get more populations covered.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I'm not sure the actual population number, but this does not include anybody in the OHP standard
it does not.
Program, which is roughly, what, 100,000
That is
persons.
Correct.
So if this was the only OHP program we had, those folks would be not served.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would note, and I'll make it available if staff does not already have it, but we did have estimates for the 0305 average monthly eligibles, and for the mandatory population, it was 348, 239, and for the Oregon optional populations, which would be CHIP and the OHP standards, it was about 151,446 for the next biennium.
Right.
You've got that. Okay.
No. That's good.
no, we need.
Okay, I'll get that to you, and because that's the kind of the count of populations that we used as we walk through these.
Okay, Senator Shields.
I'm kind of wondering if I've been in Antarctica for the last 10 years, or if I missed something here somehow. When you say you're not doing CHIP and we wouldn't do FEOP, essentially the standard OHP program, you really can't call it the Oregon Health Plan anymore, can you? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, I misspoke, Senator Shields. It's not that we didn't say we didn't want to do it. The exercise to date was to try to get to a balanced budget for the mandatory population, and then we all head up on the board. The next steps that we want to look at are CHIP, pregnant women, and the standard populations. But our exercise was as characterized first rail. First, the mandatory population. But we are very sensitive to what you've just raised.
Right. Kind of a clarification, Barney. In no way do I intend to be shooting the messenger. I mean, okay, and I have always had great respect for you. When I'm looking for somebody that knows what they're doing around this building, I come looking for you. And I mean that sincerely. I'm just saying, at this point, all we've really addressed is just the Medicaid population, right? I mean, we really haven't got beyond that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, thank you for the compliment. But I think at this point, what you've heard today, and if the state of Oregon were to be able to do more, no more than this, we would be a state with a basic Medicaid program.
Okay. Right. An entitlement program. What I guess we haven't begun to talk about, and I raised the issue once and was told probably that's why they didn't invite me to start with, is additional revenue. And I did raise that issue one time.
No, it's because
and I was told, Bill, that's not why we're here. Be quiet, sit down, don't talk about that. So I didn't. Sometime at some point we'll have to do that. We will do that. And once we hit the bottom line. But I, too, want to say that I really, really appreciate your facilitating. I think you did a great job, and I know that you were frustrated in various ways. The numbers would change every once in a while, and no one was quite sure for a long time.
I have a greater appreciation for the work that Senator Winters and her colleagues do with budget numbers.
Uh-huh. And I think Dr. Bates, when the first meeting I was at, it just kind of burst someone's balloon when he said, hey, you're about $30 million off or whatever. And so, lo and behold. But it's a very difficult situation. And I do appreciate and understand that you have to start at the beginning and figure out what we have, what we're going to lose, how we can make greater efficiency and economize and try to close that gap. And I think once we do all of that, then we look around for other alternatives. And so I understand we're not at that point yet. We're still trying to internalize the cuts that are going to happen. And I don't think we've even heard the final forecast. I know we haven't. So that maybe even more. Senator Winters, did you have
something? Well, only to say that, you know, it did start from a base of where we are, what we know where we are, and those figures continue to move as we continue to rebalance the budgets. And the other piece that you probably should also know, as you're building back and talking about the below-the-line figure, the 519, that there's some discussion that probably with CMS would go for that if we did have CHIP back or the children back in that equation. Without that, there's the possibility that they would not agree up to that level. It is a very painstaking process when you begin to consider taking in what currently is the revenue projection and then saying we are back where we're talking basic mandatory Medicaid. And then what can we, even with the basics, if we didn't add prescriptions to it, we would be the only state in the country that did not offer prescriptions to that population. And so the group dealt with it from those bases of what's the next level to add, you know, what really can, given the resources that we have, what's practical. I don't think there's any other way to put it, but it was what's practical. And I want to commend the stakeholders in the group for sitting down working through this process and both this process as well as the mental health one, which we did not get as far with them as we did with the Oregon Health Plan. And we have another group who's doing the same thing, and that's on the Commission for Children and Families. They are coming to the table to try to assist us all in this process, given the limitation of dollars that we're all facing and working with.
Okay. Yes. Okay. We have another half-hour presentation, but go ahead, Senator Menendez, Senator Shields.
I was just going to reiterate, I did introduce via the House Rules Committee a broad-based employer tax for the FEOC program. So I think given some of the starkness of the numbers that you're seeing in front of you and the need to, well, it depends on what CMS does. I mean, we have a waiver that we're largely out of compliance with or will be out of compliance with. That sets up a whole different set of legal questions that will have to be answered, but I think eventually it will dawn on the legislature that something will need to be done in one form or another. So I do appreciate what the stakeholder group has done in terms of reducing this down to an analysis that helps us know what the baseline is, because then we can add back, hopefully consciously, from that point.
Okay. Senator Shields.
Just very briefly, Barney, I know that you concentrated on this, but maybe outside a committee, can you give us some, or me at least, some rough numbers on what it would take to add back the CHIP, the FEOP, you know, the other stuff that's gone? Or can
I could tell you the CHIP numbers is $12 million of state funds, so it's relatively
cheap.
The FEOP, we didn't look at FEOP. The FEOP budget, I believe, is in the magnitude of $20 million, so that's a separate budget item. What I don't have, and we could probably get it through a committee request, is what would be the buyback cost of the standard population with, for example, current benefits, and also the buyback cost of the pregnant women from 133 to 185. And I think those are probably readily available, and either Ms. Taylor or others could probably get it from OMAP.
Yeah, that would be helpful for us to have.
Good.
Thanks.
Thank you much, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay, our next information hearing, Joel, would you please come up? Joel, would you introduce yourself, please? Oregon Insurance Division.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to talk about an overview of the mandates. Yes, I understand you will have several specific mandates in front of you starting later this week, and my job is to give you an overview of that topic from the insurance division's perspective. Whenever you're involved in a discussion of a specific mandate, I think there are two kinds of conversations going on. One is in terms of the specific costs and benefits of that particular mandate, but increasingly in the legislature in the last several sessions, there's a second conversation that's always fairly close to the surface, which is, even if this particular mandate has only limited impact and limited cost, what is the overall effect on continuing to add mandates to the insurance benefit package, and that discussion goes in a number of different ways, and that's the discussion I'm going to try to focus on today, is some of the broader dynamics that are at play. What I think you have in front of you, or should have in front of you, is a report that we published in November entitled Health Insurance Mandates, and that's kind of my text for the next few minutes here. I'll try to be fairly brief, by the way, so that I can take questions here too. We've been asked these questions for at least the last several sessions about overall impact of mandates, and are there any studies out there that sort of price out what portion of the premium package or claims costs are wrapped up in mandates, so in questions like that. About starting back in probably 1999, we started to take a more careful look at that question, and whether the answer that we found was there wasn't anything yet published for Oregon, so we looked at the question and said, could we do some kind of survey of the carriers to determine what costs are here in Oregon. And we started to put together some survey instruments, and we started to talk to the carriers, and the basic gist of the experience was that each time we brought a set of questions out for kind of testing with those who'd have to answer them, the questions got more complex. while it would be different if you're asking about the individual market versus the group market, and it would be different in this geographical place than that geographical place, et cetera, et cetera. So we, in the end, decided that we probably couldn't do that kind of survey without some more money and some more actuarial support and some very rigid and rigorous kinds of premises to the report. And so instead, we turned our eye towards the next best thing, which is let's look at what other states have done in the area of studying mandates and see if we can learn anything from that. And that's really what you have in the report that's in front of you today. The meat of that report is summaries of studies done in four other states, and then there's actually one study from Oregon that I'll come back to at the end here. But the two states, as you look at that report, I think the two states that give you the best guidance on what the overall cost of mandates, cost and benefits of mandates might be are Virginia and Maryland, and they use two methodologies which are probably the two that we would use one or both of if we were to do a study here in Oregon. The Virginia approach is to require insurers, large insurers, not all insurers, but the large insurers in their market, I think there are 44 of them that they require reporting from, to provide cost and utilization data on all of the Virginia mandates on an annual basis. They've been doing this since 1993. And so they have a fair amount of data and a fair number of reports now built up, and I think it gives something of a read on the overall market. What they find, I'll highlight a couple things there, are one, the most expensive mandates are first the mental health and substance abuse mandate, and secondly, the maternity mandate. And that, I think, would turn out to be true here. It has turned out to be true in all of the different states that we looked at in this study, and I think also in some other studies that have been done. In the Virginia study, they find that the mental health and substance abuse mandate is about a 4.2% factor on premium, and the maternity mandate is a 6.1% factor on premium. The other significant fact I'll highlight from the Virginia report is in their 2000 report, which is the one that's summarized in our report, it's based on 1998 data, they found that overall mandates accounted for 15.2% of premium. And they looked at it in a different way. When looked at in terms of how much of claims costs are accounted for, it was in the individual market 9.1%, and in the group market 18.8%, which also would be typical of most studies of this nature. There are fewer mandates in Oregon and in most other states on the individual market than on the group market. So the core number I'd take away from that is the 15.2% of premium is the overall cost of mandates. On the Maryland study, rather than rely on data from the carriers submitted and analyzed by the state, the Health Care Commission there is charged itself with doing an annual study, and they hire an actuarial firm, and I believe it was Milliman and Roberts that did the studies for Maryland. And again, in their 2000 report, they estimated the total cost of mandates as against premium at 13.1%, so slightly less than the Virginia study, but in the same ballpark, 15.2 versus 13.1. A second aspect of that study that I thought was particularly interesting is they go on to analyze what they call the marginal cost of mandates, and here's where you get into some of the kinds of issues that get discussed in sort of heated ways sometimes in the legislature. And the marginal cost is the cost of what the mandate being a legislative mandate adds to the overall health bill. The assumption of a marginal cost analysis is that certain amount of the spending on mandates would happen anyway, regardless of what the legislature did. So how much cost is the legislature really adding when they impose a mandate? And what they found was that 3.4% of the cost was as a result of the legislation. In other words, most of the cost, two-thirds to three-quarters of the cost of mandates, would be incurred anyway in health plans because the consumers and the businesses would demand it. So 13.1% of premium is the overall cost of the mandate, but the marginal cost is 3.4% in that study.
Now, may I interrupt here? There's an interesting bill before the legislature this time that asks the Department of Human Services to talk about what happens to people when we cut programs? I mean, what's the cost of cutting a program, a benefit program? What's the cost shift? Who picks up the cost? Is it the jail? Is it the emergency room? Is it the undertaker who has to pick dead people off the street and service them and so on? I mean, that's pretty gross, but what we're looking at here are the costs to the people who pay the insurance. We're not dealing with any other cost of mandates. Right? Are we dealing with the benefits of mandates somewhere in here?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. There's a little bit in the Texas report that I'm going to come to in a minute about the social benefits, but when you look at the literature here and you look at what states have done, they primarily focus on cost because that's where you can get real numbers. In the Texas studies I'll describe in a minute, they try to assess certain kinds of social benefits, but they don't end up putting cost figures on those. They instead rank them high, medium, and low. And I'll show you a chart in here in just a minute of how that works. But I think the gist of your point is correct, that it's most of the study focuses on the measurable costs, and it's much harder to get your arms around the social benefits of mandates. And so that's not as much discussed in the literature. Coming now to the Texas study, rather than Texas, there are two studies that are summarized in our report. The first is a 1998 study, which really was similar to our study in the sense that it basically went out and looked at what the literature was at that time back in 1998 and did some surveying of insurers just with more general questions about the cost of mandates. And one thing I found interesting in that study, when they asked their large insurers to estimate the cost of mandates, they got answers ranging from 2% of premium to 20% of premium, and that's not dissimilar from the kinds of information that we got when we were just trying to do a little bit of initial work on whether we could do a survey. The assumptions that are made here, obviously, I don't think the numbers vary 2 to 20 between insurers, so a lot depends on the assumptions that go in, and that's what you'd end up hiring actuaries to work out. They also found at that time in 1998 that the literature that was out there found the cost of mandates varying among the states from 5% to 20%. That's probably still the range today. There's probably still some studies out there that would suggest mandate costs are in the 5% range, and at the high end it would be up in around 20%. And again, I think it probably clusters more like in the mid-teens, like 13, 14, 15 percent. The second study they did in Texas was by Millman and Robertson. It was in 2000, and they looked at 13 specific mandates and found that the costs of those mandates were 7.8% of premium. And if you look at the chart here, Mr. Chairman, going back to your question, I think it's I have to find it here in the material, but it's on page 14 of our handout. It's table A5, Texas Health Insurance Mandates. You'll see there that for the 13 mandates they looked at, and it starts with the big ones, chemical dependency benefits, serious mental illness, and pregnancy. They made an attempt to evaluate the health and social effects of the mandates. And so, for instance, for chemical dependency benefits, they find a positive impact on health status, a high impact on physical health, and a high impact on economic or social well-being. And they find the same thing for the serious mental health mandate, and for pregnancy complications, they find a very high physical health impact and a low or no impact on economic or social effects. So they try to make these kinds of judgments, and we have all of these studies and could make them available to the committee at your request. Some of them are quite voluminous. The fourth study that we looked at was a study from the state of Maine, and that came up with a relatively low-end number of 7.5% for the overall costs of mandates. But when we looked into that study, it sort of mixed methodologies, and in some cases they talked about the full cost of a mandate, and in some cases they were estimating the marginal cost of a mandate, meaning the cost of, you know, assuming many people will take the service anyway, how much did the mandate actually add in new cost? So they came up with a 7.5%. 5% number. And then finally, there's a relatively old study from Oregon. We put it in here because it was an Oregon study. It was done by Associated Oregon Industries back in 1991. And they looked at the mandates that then existed in Oregon and found that those mandates looked just at Blue Cross as a carrier and found that the mandates accounted for roughly 8.1% of claims costs there. So that's a very quick run through of what we found in looking at other states. And again, the high points I'd draw you back to are probably, if you had to take an average there, the average is going to find that mandates overall are somewhere in the teens in terms of their cost of the premium dollar. The two biggies by far are mental health and chemical dependency is number one, and then number two would be maternity and pregnancy-related mandates. Beyond that, most of them are relatively on their own insignificant, small numbers, but as people frequently point out around here, small numbers can add up to bigger numbers. The other two things, points I'll make before taking questions are, if you turn to page 16 of our material, I believe it is, page 17, it's appendix B of our material, that outlines the 22 mandates that currently exist in Oregon, or at least I guess they'd still be the right ones because they were in 2002. I don't think the legislature's yet enacted and had a mandate signed this session, so this 22 is still good as of today. And they're divided into the two common categories that mandates are divided into, sort of diseases and conditions or specific benefits that must be provided. And then secondly, on the second page there, you'll see provider reimbursement mandates. We have 12 benefit mandates and 10 provider mandates. And then if you read across the chart, you can see a brief description of each of them, the statute that authorized it, when it was adopted. Is it subject to repeal under the, I'll come back and talk about this in a minute, the automatic repealer statute in Oregon 743-700. And then finally, a couple other columns. Is it just a state mandate or also a federal mandate? You'll note there are only two federal mandates, one of them for breast reconstruction, the other for minimum maternity stays. So most mandates are state. And then in the next column, who does it apply to in terms of types of insurers? And you'll see self-insurance, except for the federal mandates, self-insured entities, which are large businesses essentially, probably a third of the market or thereabouts, mandates do not apply to that marketplace. And then finally, do they apply to small group, large group, or individual? And you'll note that most mandates apply to large groups, most apply to small group, and a fewer number apply to individual benefit plans. So I'm happy to take questions on any of those specific mandates, but that's kind of a chart that we use quite a bit with questions that come in about the mandates here in Oregon. And then finally, before I turn to questions, a couple points that we make in our recommendation section, which is on page 9 of our report. There are a couple things that the legislature has done in the past to try to get a handle on the broad overview, overall effect of mandates. One is there's a statute, ORS 171.880, which requires an analysis of a mandate from either the sponsor or some proponent of a mandate when the mandate is submitted for consideration by the legislature. And if you read through the statute, which we have copied it in our report here, it all suggests that there'd be a lot of valuable information on each mandate, including the cost, and there's questions about its social benefit as well. Unfortunately, when we looked for that material for our report, we discovered that there isn't any repository for that material, and so I'm told that sometimes it's done, sometimes it's not even done, and whatever is done, no one has a record of, except to the extent somebody may keep it in their files on a particular bill. So we were unable to obtain that material, and if that is an important objective for the legislature to have overall understanding of mandates and why they were passed and what the benefits and claim costs were, it might be useful to put some teeth in that particular statute so that the material would be available. There is also, I mentioned, a mandate repealer statute, 743-700. That was passed same time as the first one in the 1985 legislative session. And the notion there, I think, was that we want to come back and revisit these mandates on a periodic basis and see whether they're delivering what we thought they were and so forth. And that statute has worked to repeal a couple of mandates, fairly minor ones, but what's tended to happen under that statute is that the there's an extension on the mandate, and so mostly that statute hasn't been a terribly effective way of controlling the cost of mandates, at least up to today. And I know it seems to be a favorite device in the bills that we've seen for this session to draft them even now with an exemption from 743-700. So that, again, if the legislature is interested in a broader handle on mandates, you may want to take a look at whether that's the right approach or there's a better approach or add teeth to that or otherwise it's not terribly been terribly effective as a strategy to date. And then finally, if we wanted to do a study like we did, like the studies that I cited in these other states, we could do it. In the last one that we know of that was done for the state of Texas by Middleman and Roberts in the year 2000, the price tag then was about $500,000. So it's not a cheap thing. I think it might not be the first thing on your list as legislators in this particular session, but I raised that because that's to do it right. It looks like that's, from our perspective, would be the cost factor on it.
A few minutes ago, you made reference to social benefit, but other than that reference, I guess this is a philosophical question that I'm asking first, and maybe it's appropriate to ask the philosophical ones before you get to specific ones, and that is, when you talk about the cost of mandates, the first question that comes to my mind is, compared to what? You know, cost of the mandate compared to what? Compared to not having the mandate is the obvious rest of the equation, and it seems like you have the cost, but the compared to what part you just said you don't have, or there's no way to get that. Is that what I heard you saying, or am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, no, I think you got it basically the way I said it, which is that other than that Texas study, we didn't find any serious discussion of benefits. What you tend to find, if it was mentioned at all, would be a general discussion saying there are some social benefits to the mandates that we have, but they're difficult to measure. They're external to the health care premium dollar often, et cetera, and so there really isn't any counterweight to the cost factors, similarly quantifiable material, and that is probably why we'll continue to have debates over the philosophical issues mandate by mandate.
Just following on that, okay. Kind of, I'm reminded just now of what Senator Minnis said earlier in our earlier discussion when he was talking about, you know, using a particular prescription as versus having that person maybe end up in the criminal justice system, you know. And I can see this applying in the same kind of way. You know, if you have a mandate, something gets covered, you can have, so it's not just a social benefit. I guess what I'm saying is it's not just a social benefit. There can be a price tag as well if there was a complete study. You know, and you don't see that anywhere is kind of what I'm saying. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, again, I think there is some discussion of that, and the Texas study tries to grapple with that, and they have this scheme that I went through very briefly here of trying to rank different kinds of social benefits from high to low in different categories. But that study was done by actuaries whose living is, you know, trying to quantify things and make them precise. I mean, actuaries today are trying to calculate, you know, the cost of terrorism to the country. So they'll take on pretty much any kind of task. But when it came to the task of the social benefits on mandates, they didn't come up with numbers. They came up with high, low, medium types of assessments.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me in the Texas study particularly, and I believe in other studies as well, you talked about marginal cost, but in the Texas study you said from 2% to 20%. Again, those companies must have been looking at marginal costs if they were on the low end of that, rather than the actual cost if you considered the mandate is being added
expense to the company that would not have been borne otherwise.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I think that's probably an excellent observation. I don't know for sure on the study to confirm that, but that would, my guess would be that that would be one of the factors that would play into that range of estimates.
Senator Mass?
Well, the question I have is, you say we don't have any data or any information relevant to mandate, non-mandate. We do have self-insureds who do not come under the mandates. Isn't there an appropriate comparison with the cost of health plans or policies in the self-insured categories as opposed to those that are required to meet the mandates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, you could derive some information that way. And I do think that we have pretty good information here. I think the numbers on the cost of the mandate, what it actually costs to have the mandate, are not as speculative and as open-ended as the social benefits. So I do, if you looked at these studies, I do think we are coming fairly close in these numbers. You know, we're coming in between the 10 and 20% range, probably closer to 15 than any other number. So there is that. You could get some more information by looking at the self-insured, but again, if you go back to the marginal cost kind of concept, if you look at self-insured plans with large employers, they tend to be generally rich plans, and they do tend to include many of the things that are mandated in these coverages. So, for instance, you won't find a lot of large groups that don't have some mental health benefit or some maternity benefit, which are, again, the two big price items.
And, Mr. Chairman, I guess that is, in fact, my point, that when given an opportunity to not have mandates, most large employers who are do not come under the mandates have them anyway. They cover them anyway. So it seems to me that that's instructive. So it becomes more of an academic discussion, in my opinion, about whether mandates do or do not have an impact in the healthcare markets. It just seems to me that most of these people who are self-insured cover them anyway. That, to me, is instructive.
Well,
Mr. Chairman,
let me get something to that, and then I'll come to Senator Fisher. I think also that self-insured, I know we've talked about this in committee before, that workers' comp self-insured emphasize prevention, emphasize good health, exercise, all of the kinds of things that will prevent people from getting sick, and I could see maybe the prevention in the self-insured might be stronger. It would make sense to me if it was, but... Senator Fisher.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, many of the large self-insureds are also union, and those are bargain issues, not necessarily that they're wanting to or doing it anyway. It's a matter that those things are bargain. But I had a concern. I spent a lot of the 93-94 interim as chair of the House Alcohol and Drug Study Group. And we were given all kinds of information on the fact that for every dollar we spent in chemical dependency issues brought back $10, $15, $20 in savings and so forth. And it's interesting here that Texas is saying that for every $100 they spend in the chemical arena, dependence arena, they only get $24 back. Do they get that $100 back plus the $24, or does... Do they spend $100 and save $24?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I believe that I'd have to look at it carefully, but I believe the $24 number is the total they get back, not the $100 plus the $24. But I also believe they qualify that by saying that this is some of it that they can capture. I think a lot of the problem with capturing those social benefits are that they're not captured back into the healthcare system. Somebody mentioned fewer people in prison and that sort of thing, and so when you're trying to capture those sorts of numbers, how many fewer people are in prison because they had, you know, alcohol treatment or something, you can imagine the difficulty of you know, setting up your assumptions to determine exactly when that was the cause and when it wasn't. And so that's the kind of problem, I think, that puts this issue back squarely in your lap as the legislature. You're ending up with value judgments and philosophical statements from different sides on most of these mandates that can't be rigorously tested, or at least we don't know how to do it yet.
Well, I would certainly say, Mr. Chair, that as long as I've been here, I've never seen somebody coming in and saying, oh, you spent $10 million over in alcohol and drug, now we don't need $30 or $40 million in the district attorney's office or over judicial or corrections or something like that.
Well, Yeah, I had a conversation just yesterday with someone from the Corrections Department, and my question to them was, what data do you have that people who are in prison or jail have some alcohol drug contributing factor? And those are assumptions, and 94% in robberies, I heard, was one statistic that alcohol drug involvement led to a very, very high rate of robbery, which led to a very high rate of incarceration, and so on. I mean, it's a circular thing. And I'd like to see a study done in the prison system to try to get a handle on who's there and why. But these are philosophical things as well as value.
Mr. Chairman, they're not philosophical discussions, and that's not the point I'd like to make. The National Institute of Corrections has done major studies on the issues of mental health patients and persons with alcohol and drug problems that are in prisons. It is not conjecture or a social philosophical discussion. There is a very distinct trend in our nation of individuals going to prison who have mental health or alcohol and drug-related problems. 18% of the national population, those persons in prison today, have mental health or drug and alcohol problems. That is a fact that's been documented by study after study. This trend is moving upward. That's a huge problem. Many of you were here in Oregon when we had Damage State Hospital as a mental health facility that was otherwise known as asylum. It doesn't exist anymore. And we deinstitutionalized it and put it back in the community and did not construct a mental health system in our communities. All of those social constructs have a consequence. So it's not just a philosophical argument.
I guess what it boils down to a philosophical argument, because I haven't seen the hard data, and I don't know if you can come up with it, but what did you say, 18%?
18%.
Well, the figure that I was given a figure of 90-some percent.
For robbery.
For robbery, yeah. And so it would be nice, it would be helpful, I guess, if we could get it out of the philosophical discussion and get it into some hard numbers.
I will get the information to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And we may call you back.
I'll be happy to come back. And what did Barney say? Have fellowship, right?
Thanks. Oh, we are adjourned.